create about certain kind of vibe what we live through, and we kind of expand it to the island, but don't really know about them part of the music scene. So in the meantime, we're gonna just come out for the ear now, and then we're gonna just give it over to After Hours. And before I go, I have to send one more condolence going out to Pam and the family. I have to big up the icons of the reggae music them. See? Man like Frank Paul, cause you have a whole lot of artists them and drop out and things. So Frank Paul.
There is this thing going on.
What
you realize
our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CQT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 8 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what prisons are and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties between incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understandings of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in sharing past archives or collaborating on programming to contact us. You can email news@ckut.ca or prison@ckut.ca. Or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CKUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.ckut.ca online.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we are your hosts for today's show. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we'll be speaking live on the phone with Mustafa Hinaway about the hunger strike by Palestinian prisoners that just ended. We will also be hearing part of a presentation on queer prison justice by Ardeth Wynot, who teaches poetry at Dorchester Penitentiary on Mi'kmaq territory in so-called New Brunswick. But first, we'll start the show with some news.
Six more Dakota Access Pipeline cases were dismissed last month. Mark Lobato, David Packenham, Ronald Williamson, Lorenzo Cerna, Victor Puertas, and Sean Jordan were among 126 people charged with criminal trespass and engaging in a riot on October 22nd in connection with the Dakota Access Pipeline protest in southern Morton County. Some had attached themselves that day to a vehicle found at the construction site. A total of 761 arrests were made during the protests, according to the North Dakota Joint Information Center.
Sekou Kambui, former Black Panther and New African political prisoner, passed away last month at the age of 68. Audrey Scott Williams stated, quote, "Our dear brother and Black Panther comrade, Sekou Kambui, born William Turk, made his transition on May 9th. The struggle for freedom defined him in so many ways. After 47 years as a political prisoner in Alabama prisons and his release in 2012, he can now rest in peace. Farewell, dear friend."
June 28th of this year will mark 1 year since Eric King was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and 1 year since he stood up in court in Kansas City, Missouri. His support committee is proud to announce the first annual International Day of Solidarity with Eric King on June 28th, 2017. So please mark your calendars and keep Eric King on your mind. You can help build and maintain a base of support with us that will last for the next 6 years of his 10-year sentence. For more information about his case, you can visit supporterickking.org.
ECO prisoner Marius Mason is out of administrative segregation. On May 8th, Marius was moved out of the Carswell Federal Medical Center's administrative unit into general population. While this is a far cry from freedom, for the first time in nearly 7 years, Marius is able to see the sky and feel the grass beneath his feet. Marius Mason is a transgender prisoner at the Federal Women's Prison near Fort Worth, Texas, on the Carswell military base. Mason is serving a 22-year sentence for his underground actions against logging and genetic engineering in which no one was injured. He was convicted in 2008 based on the testimony of an informant.
Chelsea Manning has been freed from prison. Chelsea Manning exited the walls of Fort Leavenworth Military Prison in Kansas on the morning of May 17th. Chelsea went at the age of 20 to fight in the Iraq War, believing it was noble, only to discover the dark reality not only of that war, but of the U.S. government's actions in the world generally, including war crimes, indiscriminate slaughter, complicity with high-level official corruption, and systematic deceit of the public. In the face of these discoveries, Chelsea knowingly risked her own liberty to disclose the most important journalistic archives in history, documents to the world that would reveal the truth with no expectation of benefit to herself. And so Chelsea Manning is a hero, and we welcome her home.
Prisoners in Folsom State Prison in California have been on hunger strike since May 25th, 2017. They are demanding that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation provide adequate access to courts and legal assistance, meaningful education, self-help courses, and rehabilitative programs, that the state allow possession of televisions, provide exercise equipment, including pull-up bars for meaningful exercise in the yard, that they end cruelty, noise, and sleep deprivation of welfare checks, keep original proper packaging for commissary and canteen food items, that they give non-disciplinary status to qualifying prisoners, provide adequate and appropriate clothing and shoes, and provide food bowl and cup. You can find more information about the hunger strike at prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com.
And next on the show, we are going to hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking about sunshine in Palestine, after which we will hear an interview with Mustafa Hanawi about Montreal Solidarity Actions with the prisoners. This is the Prison Radio Show here on CQT.
Sunshine in Palestine. On Saturday past, hundreds of Palestinian political prisoners announced a stunning victory against the repressive conditions in Israeli prisons. After Israeli prison officials granted some concessions, a majority of Palestinian prisoners engaged in a huge hunger strike called off the 40-day action. According to these officials, some 1,578 prisoners joined the strike, and 834 ended it on Saturday, the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. 18 others were hospitalized. The hunger strike was led by Marwan Barghouti, a political prisoner who has been held by the occupation forces for 13 years and also a commander of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The prisoners were protesting poor food, overcrowding, denial of educational opportunities, better medical care, and an end to solitary confinement. Another key demand was an end to what Israeli officials term administrative detention or confinement without trial or even a charge. The Palestinian prisoners prevailed on all these points. The hunger strike, called Strike for Dignity and Freedom, was a bold political action against the Israeli apartheid state. The Palestinian Prisoner Support Network, Samidun, praised the prisoner hunger strikers for their steadfastness and saluted their victory. They also seriously critiqued the International Red Cross for its failure to support a second monthly family visit, citing budgetary concerns. Samidun and other Palestinian supporters praised the prisoners' action and noted that Israel holds some 6,000 Palestinian prisoners, including children, illegally. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
We are now joined live on the phone by Mustafa. Mustafa was involved in organizing the Montreal demonstration in support of Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike that just ended. The demonstration happened on May 20th, 2017. It has been recently announced that the Palestinian political prisoners have suspended their hunger strike, and Mustafa is going to tell us some details and a bit more about the solidarity that's been happening outside the walls. Mustafa, welcome to the Prison Radio Show.
Between international and local struggles in terms of prison solidarity and prisoner solidarity work, not just abroad but also here.
Do you want to start over, Mustafa? We missed the beginning of your answer there.
Oh, it's just it's a real great opportunity to be able to make the links between local and international struggles for prisoners' justice and for prison abolition and to be able to talk about Palestinian prisoner struggles on a show that's focused on local struggles here in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're grateful to have you on the show. Can you tell us a little bit more about the conditions in the Palestinian prison or in the prisons where the Palestinian prisoners are held that led to the hunger strike in the first place?
Well, the conditions in terms that Palestinian prisoners face within the Israeli prison system is fundamentally one of the worst, and sort of is an arm of the Israeli occupation and of Israeli apartheid. Because the fact is that most people who are Palestinian within the Israeli prison system are there due to Israeli military law. So the state of Israel applies two sets of laws. One, towards Israeli citizens, and then Israeli military law towards Palestinians in the occupied territory. So most of the Palestinian prisoners within the Israeli justice system are there as a result of what's called administrative detention. And so administrative detention means is a military judge, no trial, uh, no real justification is needed, where a military judge can sign off on 6 months of detention and can be renewed or extended by a military judge every 6 months. And so the result of that system is that sort of Israel uses this to be able to put down any resistance to Israeli apartheid and the occupation. And it's not just simply, so for example, to give a few examples of Israeli military laws within the occupied territories, any gathering of more than three people can be considered illegal under Israeli military law. If you're a child and are throwing a stone against a military or a tank that is participating in illegal occupation, you could end up years within Israeli prison, and are currently over 300 Palestinian children inside the Israeli prison system. So the Israeli prison system itself is based very much as a tool to collectively punish the Palestinian population for resisting Israeli apartheid. And the conditions that Palestinians actually face within inside is extremely restrictive. Torture is widespread, and Israel never confirms nor denies. You have to remember, Israel is a state without a constitution. It illegally detains children, despite international law. The Israeli state makes it extremely difficult for families to visit Palestinian prisoners as a result of, let's say, the blockade in Gaza or the occupation in the West Bank. So the separation between family members and prisoners is quite extensive. And it's very difficult for Palestinian prisoners to get out or to be released because the law doesn't apply to them.
Can you tell us some of the basic details of the strike? I know there were that the strike lasted for 40 days, that there were tons of people involved. Can you talk a bit more about like those logistical details of the strike?
So the hunger strike began on April 17th, and April 17th is International Palestinian Prisoner Day. And so the strike began, it is not the first mass hunger strike that took place by Palestinian political prisoners, but it was the largest on scale, and they had begun actually organizing the previous year. So this was 1 year in the making. So the organizing committee, which was organized, there are which support groups, is also the club or association of Palestinian political prisoners, both former prisoners and prisoners who remain inside. And so they had organized an unending hunger strike that initially was 800 prisoners, but had expanded to 1,600. And there are currently 6,000 Palestinian prisoners. So one out of four prisoners were on hunger strike. And the demands were quite extensive, but they were never extremely radical. So the demands were decreased time between visitations between family members, particularly of those in Gaza, so that they would be able to visit more frequently, would have the right to visit more frequently. The demand was to be able to have touch access to family members, people to be able to touch their children, people to be able to hug their loved ones. There was demands for increased access to telephones. There were demands around children prisoners' rights. But this was actually part of the demands, and to really, one has to sit and think about that, that 1,600 people went on an unending hunger strike to demand basic rights for child prisoners. And this is a state that considers itself a quote-unquote sort of democratic, pluralistic state. And the hunger strike tactics was that it was organized across the political spectrum in terms of the Palestinian political movement. So activists from Fatah, the PFLP, Hamas, more grassroots activists. There are activists in prison who are journalists who are working on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. There are 11 Palestinian parliamentarians in prison. So it was across the political spectrum. And so it was organized in a broad way under a broad leadership to be able to launch the call. And so initially the strike for the majority of time, while it was unended, what they were using for substance was salt and water. And at a certain point, they had actually had called for a refusal of water. And actually the Israeli army began setting up field hospitals outside of the prison at a certain at the last week of the hunger strike. And the hunger strike itself ended up lasting for 42 days. And it was considered a tremendous victory on part of the Palestinian prisoners.
Can you tell us more about the decision to end to suspend the hunger strike?
The decision to suspend the hunger strike, I mean, it was being able to sustain itself, and Israel was using cruel tactics, moving prisoners around, taunting prisoners with food while there wasn't force feeding, torture, separation, even changing prisons for the prisoners. A decision was made that they were able to achieve most of their goals in terms of their actual demands, thus calling for an end. And also after 42 days, it becomes a situation of life or death. But during the time of the negotiations at the very last two or three days, there was articles alluding to that there was some negotiating between the U.S. envoy and the prisoners, as well as the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli state. But the prisoners ended it because they were close to death, and at the same time they felt that they had achieved their limited goals in being able to sustain such a massive action. And I think the thing that they, and a letter recently published by Mustafa Barghouti, who's serving several life sentences in Israeli prison since 2004, is that the next move is to actually to push the leadership. And I think what's symbolic about the strike, too, is the timing of it, is that they chose a critical moment. This is 50 years since 1967. This is the 69th anniversary of the Nakba, or the catastrophe when two-thirds of the Palestinian population were expelled from their lands. And so that as much as there was concrete demands, I think this was to Palestinian Authority is a more radical leadership, and that there is a leadership, a grassroots leadership, that will challenge the occupation, whether it be in the prisons or outside the prison. And the letter that Mustafa Barghouti, one of the leaders of the hunger strike, issued was that now that the Palestinian Authority should not commence any negotiation with the State of Israel until all of the prisoners are released. Mm. So that the hunger strikers themselves are considering ways of being able to move forward to be able to demand their own release as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about what outside support for the strike has looked like? I know you helped organize a demonstration that happened here in Montreal. Were there other things happening in other places?
There was incredible support globally for the hunger strike. And one source that I think that needs to be commended is a website called Sami Doun, which is Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, which acted like an information hub before all of the solidarity actions that were taking place globally. And it was quite extensive. So you had demonstrations in Karachi. You had in Ireland, the city hall in Dublin, fly the Palestinian flag in solidarity with the hunger strike. You had motions in the Irish Parliament in solidarity with the hunger strike. You had demonstrations right across Europe. You had statements from former political prisoners here across Turtle Island in support of Palestinian political prisoners. You had demonstrations like the one we had organized in major cities, and there was two global days of action around the hunger strike, and even it had gone all the way to the Quebec National Assembly by Amir Kadir. So I think we were it was able to really highlight the injustice that Palestinian prisoners were facing. And one of the things that the solidarity looked like is how do corporations and making the links to corporations who are profiting off of the Israeli apartheid prison system. And one of those corporations is Hewlett-Packard, or HP more commonly known. And it is part of the infrastructure of the Israeli apartheid system in terms of similar to that of the role that Polaroid played in South African apartheid. In terms of being part of the past system, Hewlett-Packard is really much instrumental in the technology used by the Israeli prison authority, in terms of the checkpoints, and in terms of the security apparatus. So much of the attention focused on HP as well, and that as a concrete way of going beyond sort of just demonstrations and solidarity actions, but being able to cut the ties to the Israeli apartheid prison system.
That's it for my questions. Do you have anything else you want to add, Mustafa?
I mean, I think one of the things to add is that this is sort of one of those moments and sort of in the solidarity work here, being able to get the support from collectives like the Termite Collective, through certain days calendar and other grassroots prisoner solidarity organizations is that to make the links in terms of sort of those struggles and those campaigns, not just like HP, but also G4S, which is instrumental in the privatization of prisons here and profiting off of a similar prison system that exists here. And to be able to make those links, and also if people want to get involved and in terms of the BDS movement, in terms of supporting Palestinian prisoners, we should get in touch with Tadamon here locally, that's TADAMON.ca.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mustafa.
Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
That was Mustafa Henaway, an organizer here in Montreal with Tadamon. He was talking to us about the recently suspended hunger strike that was done by Palestinian political prisoners.
رايح تاركني وين يا حبيبي حافظ ونصيب de una vez.
Status for All. March for Justice and Dignity for All Migrants and Refugees. Sunday, June 18th, starting at 2 p.m. at Nelson Mandela Park. Join Solidarity Across Borders for the annual Status for All March. This year, we'll be marching in the streets of Côte des Neiges to demand an end to detentions, deportations, and double punishment, and to support a full regularization program for all. That's Sunday, June 18th, starting at 2 p.m. at Nelson Mandela Park, corner of Vezina and Victoria, near Metro Plamondon. More info is available at solidarityacrossborders.org. Open the Borders, Status for All, a CKUT co-presentation.
You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You just heard the song Wine Ramallah by Bukahara, which is a song about going back to Ramallah. And next on the program, we are going to hear about queer prison justice. Ardith Wynot is a sociology professor at Mount Allison University and teaches a poetry and performance program at Dorchester Penitentiary on Mi'kmaq territory in so-called New Brunswick. She gave several public lectures around the Maritimes in February and March about carceral state violence in queer, trans, and two-spirit lives. We already aired one excerpt of this talk, and here we're going to hear another segment where she discusses sexual violence and queer prison justice.
So consider this. Gender binary structures every facet of social life in contemporary settler colonialism, such as Canada. Okay, so we'll take that for granted and say, yes, that's true. Our bathrooms, our kinship structures, the division of labor, our prisons, but also the way in which we think about terms like violence, harm, victim, and offender. The gender binary is both an abstract social belief system and an everyday experience of power that is dictated by our position on it and our ability to conform to gender norms. Gender nonconformity becomes a risk factor in tumbling farther down socioeconomic hierarchies, rendering us unable to secure work, protect ourselves from violence, feed ourselves, etc. But for right now, let us consider the queer and trans experience to be one that makes a mess of oppositional or dichotomous notions of identity. So let's think about queerness as making a mess. It blurs, combines characteristics from both sides, it shares labor, it hybridizes forms that we tend to think of as opposites. Thus, when we are queer, when we are transgender, we are in many ways actually threatening the whole social order. And I take that as a point of queer pride. So what does this have to do then with prisons? Well, in a basic sense, we know our facilities are separated out according to the gender binary in this really cisgendered way based on anatomy, male, female. But the other pervasive binary that structures our whole criminal justice system is that of the victim, which is considered to be the morally correct position, and that of the offender, which is seen as a moral affront to society. These two positions tend to often be associated with masculinity and femininity, and this is a problem when we start talking about prison advocacy. We know that children considered to be male are taught to accept and use aggression, and they're praised for that in certain ways. So in this way, the gender binary also organizes the positions of victim and offender in our social world, and when we think about how violence is enacted in families and intimate partner relationships. And we have decades of feminist activism and critical thinking to thank for this kind of analysis. However, when we stay in this position, when we stay firmly rooted in dichotomous relationships between victim and offender in our analysis of social violence, I believe that we're actually contributing to the very structures that promote violence against queer people. We are erasing the experiences of gay and lesbian couples who face high rates of domestic violence, for example. And in many cases, as many studies have shown, rates of domestic violence in same-sex partnerships are equally high, and in the case of gay men in marginalized communities, actually higher than that of heterosexual cisgender couples. Prison advocacy for women living in jail tends to focus on women's previous experiences of victimization, and that's what led them to jail. And this is effective in generating empathy for women as offenders because we're quite comfortable about thinking about women in the context of victimhood. But when we stay in a level of comfort in thinking through victimization as associated with feminine traits, we also erase, for example, the fact that sexual assault can and does happen in women's prisons and, of course, in same-sex relationships, including lesbian relationships. So when we think about this kind of messy stuff, it's important when we think about prisons, because if we see prisons as an answer to these kinds of violence, we also have to account for the fact that the incarceration of folks who enact those forms of violence tends to be very gendered. So if we are to understand the factors that render queer people vulnerable within carceral spaces, we must be continually reflexive and aware of the ways in which our notions of victim and offender are connected. When we take up a queer position, when we try and mess with the organization of these concepts, say in restorative or transformative justice practice, we become open to new possibilities for how victims can also be offenders. And we can better account for the complexity of social harms and healing. But hopefully, a queer reimagining of justice can get us out of the carceral trap, which I believe has been a colossal failure in responding to the social problems of violence and poverty. And I think with recidivism rates that hover around 2/3, we can safely say that the prison project is a failure on many counts. So before we turn to the embodied experiences of queer and trans people in prison, I want to draw from a few concepts that will be helpful in thinking through different levels of violence within the prison system. So raise your hand if you've heard the term toxic masculinity. Okay, so when we talk about toxic masculinity, we're accounting for the ways in which how masculinity is taught in the gender binary can become harmful in some way. So we tend to see this term lately and in recent history deployed in conversations about the lone shooter or the school shooter type of violence. So more recently, the Oregon shooter in October 2015, his manifesto clearly outlined the ways in which misogyny and social alienation came together with tragic consequences. But discussions about toxic masculinity can help us to understand how homophobic and transphobic violence is perpetrated both within and outside of prisons. And I don't like to talk about violence within prisons without talking about how it exists outside. Because I think that thinking about it as connected and part of the spectrum is part of having a queer analysis. So I want to read to you a quote from the book Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment in the Prison Industrial Complex. It's edited by a wonderful activist and researcher, Eric Stanley and Nat Smith. And the excerpt I'm going to read for you is from a chapter written under the pen name Cholo from a currently incarcerated inmate somewhere in the United States. And Cholo writes, "The harm that the prisoners have to endure is usually performed in front of others. They do this in the hopes that these acts will provide the impression that they are not queer and will protect them from attacks by others in prison. These individuals are motivated by fear, and these acts are done in order to survive. Their survival is based on the maltreatment of others." So here, Cholo is giving us a queer reading of transphobic violence in jail. He's pointing out that toxic masculinity requires acts of violence, especially sexual violence, to secure one's safety in the institution. And in the violent and masculinized world of a men's facility, these acts of violence are currency to secure yourself safety from dehumanization. And in this sense, we want to begin to consider men's facilities as deeply implicated in teaching and perpetuating forms of toxic masculinity. They intensify the same structures of violence that exist outside the prison. So one study from Richmond, Virginia, showed that at least half of transgender individuals in that town were sexually abused or assaulted at some point in their life. Other studies have confirmed rates up to 66% of a given trans population in a community. Research from the United States shows us that trans inmates are 10 times more likely to be sexually assaulted in prison, and an incarcerated man, cisgender or not, actually faces astronomically high rates of risk for sexual violence. So prisoners in general face an incredibly high risk. Coupled with being trans, especially in a man's facility, it's a deeply troubling situation. We know that trans women of color face the highest rates of violent victimization. However, despite this, our mainstream idea of what a rape victim looks like is generally a cisgendered woman who has relationships with men in a heterosexual context. In many places in the US, and unfortunately in Canada, a trans woman with top surgery could conceivably be housed in a jail with men where she would be forced to be topless or fully naked in shower or recreational facilities. And prison overcrowding, this is a really important point. A lot of prison abolitionists argue against the building or construction of any new facilities because it furthers the prison industrial complex. If we're gonna protest building new prisons, we must acknowledge that overcrowding, especially in Canada's north, has been identified both by our correctional investigator, and these statistics take place anywhere there's a jail in the Western world where there's overcrowding, the risk for sexual assault in those facilities skyrockets. The risk for violent assault also goes up, but sexual assault specifically. However, all of this in mind, solid research on sexual violence in Canadian prisons is seriously lacking. The general research consensus is that it's not nearly as common as it is in the United States. And one particular study says, well, there's not a lot of evidence, but available evidence shows it's probably not a problem, right? And this is actually what the research literature is concluding about Canada, and most of this is, you know, 10 to 15 years old. But I know anecdotally from my work in men's facilities that sexual assault has increased as overcrowding has increased. And a lot of the men that end up in those facilities are coming from experiences of sexual violence before they even get there. Conducting research to determine the extent to which sexual assault is actually happening and impacting inmates requires cooperation of federal and provincial correctional agencies, which you can imagine has been incredibly difficult, especially under the last federal government. Federal prisons require research to be approved often at the national level, where researchers face extensive, seemingly bureaucratic delays that delay the research so long it becomes next to impossible to complete. So now I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about placement in inappropriate facilities. So the official policy of the Correctional Service of Canada is to place transgender inmates into facilities based on external genitalia. Provincial policies differ across the country, but anatomy or the status or pronoun on official identification tends to be where bureaucrats and staff take direction. The treatment of trans inmates in federal and provincial facilities has been arbitrary in most cases, and frontline staff and bureaucrats make decisions lacking in education that are often rooted in transphobia. Does anyone know where the most progressive provincial policy is in terms of trans incarceration? Which province has the most progressive? Yes, exactly. So Ontario has the best policy on trans incarceration, where pre-operative or non-binary trans offenders can choose to be housed in facilities that best reflect their gender identity. So you can imagine that that would probably reduce the risk of self-harm and also reduce their risk for sexual assault. Policies that rely on investigation of external genitalia as the deciding factor in the placement of an inmate discriminate against those who are on the trans spectrum but don't want to undergo full transition surgery, and nor should they have to. It also discriminates against those trans people who don't have access to surgeries because, say, they live in New Brunswick, the only province in Canada that doesn't have any kind of funded transgender support in the healthcare system. In all facilities, trans inmates face challenges receiving hormone therapy, where it's often difficult to receive or denied altogether. And what you often see happening is, like as I mentioned in terms of research, these bureaucratic delays in making things happen. This is a really Canadian approach to oppression that's profoundly passive-aggressive. But, oh, well, the form wasn't passed to the right person, or we'll have to ask so-and-so, we'll ask so-and-so up the chain of command. So a lot of the frustration that folks are facing in getting hormone therapy is related to this kind of endless passive-aggressive bureaucracy. We must also pay attention to how transphobia and homophobia play out in immigration detention, something we don't talk about enough. The 2014 case of Avery Edison, who was detained over an immigration issue, was misgendered and sent to a men's facility, and this brought public attention to incoherency in Canadian policies. In this particular case, Avery had a UK passport that identified her as female, and she was sent to a men's facility anyway. So perhaps we should tell the state to follow Ontario's lead in staying out of our pants when determining where we will be incarcerated. The forced inspection of genitals and misgendering of trans identities is an act of violence. It's what sociologist Irving Goffman would call a mortification of the self, or a humiliation ritual that functions to erode our power and force our conformity to the gender binary as part of our rehabilitation in the Canadian prison system. So in this way, our prison system is like a factory that seeks to produce and reproduce the gender binary and erode the important work that many traumatized, vulnerable, queer and trans people have accomplished in order to accept who they are and leave their closets behind.
That was Artis Why Not speaking about queer prison justice. Artis spoke at the Dalhousie School of Law on Queering the Carceral Landscape, GLBTQI Narratives of Justice and Imprisonment in Canada. In the next segment that we will likely air here on Prison Radio, Ardeth talks about solitary confinement and how queer people often end up in solitary confinement. And Ardeth also lists a conclusion, points of action in order to shift the landscape. And so the time is presently 5:49. You have been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and CQT.ca. We are next going to hear a song by Angel Hayes, Battle Cry, and just be forewarned that the song contains some strong language.
Money cannot buy all the love that's here tonight. All the love that's here tonight. Oh, oh, it's just you and I. So lift your hands toward the sky. Lift your hands toward the sky. Oh, oh,
it seems like yesterday that I was nothing. Then all of a sudden I'm a volcanic eruption. Then all of a sudden it's like spontaneous combustion. And I'm all up in your face yelling, you can't tell me nothing. Cause I came from the bottom, now everybody's watching. I said it was my time, now I'm everybody's clocking. And I'm just out here sprinting, I'm running right through my vision. I'm trying to outrun my past, but still trying to defeat my limits. Cause you only get one moment in this life to be great. And you give it your all, despite what it takes. And you never let them kill you, you take everything they give you. And throw it right at them and tell them it doesn't build you. And no, it don't ever break you, and no, it can't overtake you. Life's like a bed of roses, you take the thorns and you make. Sometimes you have to hurt for the cause to be reached. But one day you'll be stronger than all that you beat. And you can say, you take it and you run with it and keep going even when your sun's hidden. Because the time we spend in darkness when the rain comes is where we often find the light soon as the pain's done. There ain't material things in the world that can change the fact that you feel alone. Despite the fact that it gets hard, you take it all and you still go. Take the sun and you still grow. Lose the light and you still glow. I've been there, I'm still here, and I know how you feel. So do anything that you're about to.
That was Angel Hayes. Up next, we have another piece from prisonradio.org by Carrie Shakabuna. In it, Carrie's going to talk about the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. You might remember our interview back in the fall of 2016 with outside organizers from the organization I Am We Ubuntu Prison Advocacy Network. Crystal Roundtree and Mala Divine Mala spoke to us back in the fall about this march, which is against the 13th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution.
Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March coming to Washington, D.C. by Kerry Shakabuna Marshall. On August 19, 2017, the city of Washington, D.C. will host a Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March to draw attention and national support to amend the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution for its ratification of modern-day slavery within the U.S. prison system. The 13th Amendment has spawned various forms of penal slavery since its ratification by the then all-white U.S. Congress, such as the convict lease system, the chain gang labor system, the prisoner agricultural worker system, and the modern-day prison slave sweatshops that are euphemistically called correctional industries corporations. Today, the prison system's correctional industries corporations generate hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue from prisoners' free labor and slave wage labor. Arguably, the 13th Amendment is the most evil, contradictive, controversial, deceptive, and despicable part of the United States Constitution that there is. Arguably, because the 13th Amendment runs neck to neck in terms of depravity with the United States Constitution's decree that consider black people whom were enslaved as three-fifths of a human being for purposes of increasing Southern slave holders' voting power. All arguments aside, the duplicitous doublespeak of the 13th Amendment regarding the abolition of slavery in the United States of America harkens to a time when, after the indigenous peoples of this continent have been thoroughly decimated by Caucasians' practice of manifest destinies, genocidal wars, and pronouncements of coming in peace and war in the same breath, Native peoples reached a profound truth that the white man speaks with forked tongue. The 13th Amendment is a prime example, frozen in time for all to see, of the white man speaking with forked tongue, of an all-white U.S. government having no intention of truly emancipating black slaves, and of their Machiavellian designs to re-enslave black people within the U.S. prison systems under the guise of crime. In the first sentence of the 13th Amendment, the United States government firmly abolished chattel slavery in the U.S., whereas in the second sentence, they retained and transferred chattel slavery into its prison system as punishment for those convicted of crime. With a stroke of the enemy's pen, America went from chattel slavery to prison slavery, from mass emancipation of black peoples to mass incarceration of black, brown, and now poor white peoples. Brought to you by America, from the land of the beast and the home of the slave, let us make America know its sins against black and brown peoples. Let's struggle to amend the 13th Amendment to abolish prison slavery and for-profit prisons by attending or supporting the August 19th Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March on Washington, D.C. For additional information, go to amendthe13th.org. From the belly of the beast at Prison Radio, I am Shakabuna. Thank you for listening. Good.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The time is presently 5:58. You've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We are at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. So our next show will be airing on Friday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved in the show, you can contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at the Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.